Good morning. It's lovely to be with you. Really, really lovely. I have a friend at Campion Hall who in Oxford, the other Oxford, called Joe Simmons, who's a Jesuit. And it was he who suggested that I come here. He said, you will find a delightful community. And indeed, you are. So really, the treat is mine. And I'm learning a lot. I'm going to learn more tonight. I've just been in Notre Dame, where I tweeted about the touchstone Jesus. And of course, everybody was saying, it's touched down, you idiot. You know. So I'm learning a lot. Enculturation is harder than it looks. So I'm on this rather crazy tour. Crazy because it's, I think, 12 or 13 cities in 2.5 weeks and giving about 15 talks. So not a lot of sleep and moving around a lot. But what's buoyed me is just this, is just meeting such delightful people and such great institutions, and to find this warmth of reception towards the pontificate. I've long felt, I'm an Ignatian layman, I go on retreats, you know, each year, and it's been clear to me for the last 3 years that however unworthy I am of the task, it has fallen to me to help to explain and promote the thinking of the pontificate, especially in the Anglo-Saxon world, and above all in the United States, where I think there's been a lot of incomprehension of the Pope, not least because of those filters that exist here in so much of the Catholic media. So it's just great to be able to talk about my favourite topic with you today. So I've got this new book out, which I know a number of you have kindly bought. It just... Speak up. Do you want me to come closer like this? A bit closer? Okay. Yeah. Give me a second. Okay, so I'll... So if I'm speaking at about that level, is that all right for you? I know it's harder to hear because I'm speaking in a strange English accent, but I'll try and keep it slow. So a number of you have kindly bought my book, which just came out last week, called Wounded Shepherd, Pope Francis and His Struggle to Convert the Catholic Church. It's a provocative title. We writers like provocative titles. But behind it, there is a real idea, which is that Pope Francis is inviting the church on a journey of conversion. It's really not so much about structural reform as something much deeper, to put Christ at the center of the church. I saw him recently. I was in Rome for the whole of the October Synod on Amazonia, which was wonderful, by the way. Don't believe some of the stuff you've read. It was a brilliant synod. And at the end of it, I had the opportunity to go to Mass with him at the 7 o'clock Mass in the Santa Marta, which he celebrates every day. And I presented the book to him, and I explained why I had called him Wounded Shepherd. I reminded him of something he had said to French priests in October 2018, which is quoted in the book, in which he was talking about, you remember, that was at the height of all the sex abuse crisis and all the scandals. And he said to these priests that he invited them to be pastors in the way of Jesus, to witness to the strength of the resurrection in the wounds of this world. And he went on to say that the wounds were part of the witness. Don't be afraid, he told these priests, to look upon the wounds of the church, not in order to lament them, but to be led to where Christ is. He talks a lot about woundedness. I just gave a talk the other day at Sacred Heart Seminary in Milwaukee on the subject of Pope Francis and the Sacred Heart devotion. There's always been a strong affinity, you probably know, many of you, between the Jesuits and the Sacred Heart. And the Sacred Heart devotion is all about the week three of the spiritual exercises, where we're gazing on the crucified Christ, but also allowing us to see the world as he sees it. Anyway, I explained to him that this is why I'd chosen the title, and he went like this. He said, that's good. he was pleased. He liked it. And I was pleased that he was pleased, because I know that the title of my last book, The Great Reformer, made him a bit nervous. And I heard that. He'd recommended the book to lots of people, and I know he liked the book. But Antonio Spadaro, who's this great Jesuit in Rome, once he told me back in 2016 that he had asked the Pope whether he considered himself a great reformer. And the Pope had said no. That rather he thinks what he's doing is putting Christ at the center and then the reforms will flow from that. Now, when Antonio told me that, I kind of went, yeah, that's the kind of humble thing a pope would say. But actually, I was thinking about it a lot in writing the book, and I particularly thought back on a meeting which Francis held. I had a meeting with Francis in June last year, 2018. It was a beautiful meeting, and I mentioned it right at the beginning of the book. It was a meeting, actually, that he asked for. So he knew who I was, and we'd had plenty of exchanges, sometimes on the papal plane. I've only been on one papal trip, but and a couple of other occasions. But this was the first time that we'd sat down together, and he actually asked for the meeting. And the first thing he said to me was, which floored me, he said, thank you so much for taking the time to come and see me. And I sort of took me back, and I said, of course, of course. In fact, what had happened was that the friend in the Vatican who had brokered the meeting, so I was contacted by an official in the Vatican who I know very well, and he had said, Pope Francis would like to meet you, but he says, only when you're next in Rome and not to go to any trouble. And then the friend then said, now when are you next in Rome? And here are the dates that you should come. Anyway, so I was with him, he had said this to me, and then we sat down, and then Francis looked at me and he said, I've read various things that you've written about me, and I just have one criticism. So I braced myself thinking of all the mistakes I've made that I've had to correct and which ones are going to be. And he said, I think you're too kind to me. Demasiado benévolo in Spanish, too indulgent, you know. So I said, well, I promise to be harder on you in future. And he said, yeah, that's good. But then he went on to make a very serious point, which is one I was thinking about after the meeting. He said, you know, when I was elected in March 2013, I didn't come with some great plan. I had a small suitcase. I was ready to go back to Buenos Aires. And I've kind of been coping the best I can. Something like that, he said to me. And he said this to other people as well. I didn't come with a master plan, a great plan. And I was thinking about this in writing the book and in the title, because really he didn't come with a plan. And in a way, he's not the great reformer imposing a vision on the church. He didn't come with a plan, but he did come with a discernment, which leads me straight into the title that Father Warren gave me for this talk, which is Francis as a Jesuit. Because actually the way he is governing the church, leading the church, I should say, is a lot like a spiritual director guiding a person on the Ignatian spiritual exercises. And that's really the image I've used in the book. And it really came clear to me, particularly during the sex abuse crisis of 2018. Now, what I mean by this is that, you know, I know many of you have been on Ignatian retreats, and if you haven't, you're familiar with the idea. It's an 8-day process or a 30-day process, however you're doing it. And you have a spiritual director who accompanies you. Yeah? Now, it's not the spiritual director who changes you. He is not the agent of the change, or she is not the agent of the change. The one who brings about the change is the Holy Spirit, is God. So the spiritual director is encouraging you to open yourself to God and to clear away the obstacles to that, to clear away whatever is preventing your heart being open to the Holy Spirit. And because usually he or she is a wise person, they're familiar also with the temptations that you face that prevent that conversion. So the spiritual director is a wise person who creates the space for you to change, but isn't the author of that change, but rather enables that change. So that is the idea of in a way, that runs through the book about Francis, if you like, a hermeneutical key to understanding how he's leading the church. This is spiritual leadership of an apostolic body. This is what I've kind of really come to understand. Because when I wrote The Great Reformer, it was very easy to present the picture of a church in crisis institutionally. There were the financial scandals, there was all the sex abuse scandals, there was the crisis of kind of governance and legitimacy in the Vatican, there was all the issues of an autocratic Vatican. The bishops felt it needed to change. And therefore it was very easy, coming to write a book like this, to focus on those institutional and structural changes. But the problem with focusing on that too much, I came to realize, is that we can end up seeing him as a kind of a political leader, you know, elected with a mandate to carry out certain reforms. And that's really not quite right. He did have a mandate, a very clear mandate from the cardinals, who before the conclave were very clear that the next pope, whoever he was, had to deal with the financial scandals and all the other issues, and to reform the governance of the Curia. But that really doesn't capture the extent of the reform to which he's undertaking us. What I really want to suggest to you today is that the true purpose of his reform is the one that he told Antonio Spadaro. The idea is to put Christ at the center, which means dispossessing the church to some extent, or detaching the church of those things to which it has become too often attached: power, wealth, prestige, in order to offer Christ, because Christ can only be offered in poverty. So, as Antonio himself said to me, and I've quoted him in the book, when you put Christ at the center of your life, stuff happens. Changes happen, right? And the image he used is, it's like an earthquake, an ecclesial earthquake, as he calls it, where things then begin to fall. The things that need to collapse, collapse, and new things begin to emerge. So that's the hermeneutic key that I've used for this book. And that's why the book is not written like, some people say, accuse me of a lack of objectivity, not of being too kind to Francis, but that I should be, as it were, standing there with a scoreboard, you know, at the end of 6 years and saying he's done this and he hasn't done that. And of course, in the book, I do give an assessment of those reforms. But I'm fundamentally trying to explain the process that he's been leading the church on, and try to help people understand the objectives of that. That said, I do deal in chapters 3 and 4, particularly with the financial reforms. It's a good story. It's worth reading. I know it sounds dull. Financial reform sounds dull, but it's quite exciting because people end up in jail and there's leaks and there's all sorts of things happening. I mean, this is the Vatican. We're never too far away from scandals and stories. But in fact, what you'll see from the chapter is that Francis's role was to set the whole thing in motion. He appoints this body called COSEA and gives them the mandate of auditing the Vatican. Why is the Vatican spending too much? Where is the waste? Where is the accountability? And then COSEA then recommends the setting up of the Secretariat of the Economy, and then we have these reforms being driven. But, you know, Francis gives them the guidelines. He says, this is what I want. This is what I need you to do. But then lets them get on with it. And similarly, in chapter 4, which is about it's called A Time to Serve, which is about the transformation of the Curia. Again, the structural, technical governance reform he hands over, doesn't he, to the group of cardinals called the C9. And it's they who very slowly begin to implement these structural changes, while he takes on himself the task, the principal task, of converting the culture. So really, this is what he's about. He's about converting the culture and the mindset of the Curia, while at the same time introducing the practice of synodality, the practice of listening, of participation in the reformed synods, and we've had a number of them under Francis, which have been very dynamic mechanisms of ecclesial discernment, which open up new paths for the application of church doctrine and law in new pastoral circumstances. A very important dynamic part of the pontificate, but he sort of sets it in motion rather than actually imposing it. So that's why so much of the change of this pontificate has not taken place at the superficial level where mostly we judge change to happen. That's to say, the structural reforms in Rome, there have been very substantial ones. We have new bodies, a number of new bodies. But, you know, you wouldn't look at the Vatican after 6 years and say there's been this huge revolution. And indeed, as I say in the book, after 6 years of this pontificate, he has changed fewer heads of dicasteries, that's to say Vatican departments, he has changed fewer after 6 years than both John Paul II and Benedict had changed at the same point in their pontificate. So in many ways, he's been a very, very patient reformer. And in fact, it frustrates those people who are close to Francis in Rome that he leaves in place so many people. In reality, as I also show, what he does is he quietly ignores them, the ones who are resisting him, and he works with the number two of that congregation. But the point is, he's not cutting off heads. He's not carrying out a revolution. This is a patient process of change. And why? And the answer is because it is about cultural change. It's about conversion of minds and hearts. And that is always a slow, gradual, patient process. So his thinking is this, and this was explained to me very well by somebody very close to him. If you change the structures before you've changed the culture, then you create a problem, because the structures can then be used by people with the same mentality to do the same things. In other words, the structures are subverted. Equally, if you change people too soon, before you've changed the mentality and the culture, again, the idea is you bring about a change of culture slowly, and then you bring in new structures to support that change, and gradually you retire people and bring up new people from below. So this is why the process is slow. But at the heart of it is this, actually, despite the slowness of the reform, you see that the effect of this has actually been very dramatic. In Rome, over the last 6 years, it's been a very turbulent place where people are very angry, they feel things are happening, things are out. So there's a strong sense of threat. People know that the change is happening. As an example, by the way, of the success of the transformation of that culture, and what is the objective here? It's to turn the Vatican from an instrument of control over the bishops to being an instrument of service to the local church worldwide. And as proof of the change of that culture, I have many quotes in the book from bishops who go to Rome, as the US bishops now are, on their what's called ad limina visits, which means every 6 or 7 or 8 years, the bishops' conference of a country goes to the Vatican and they visit the various departments and then they have a meeting with the Pope. Now, it used to be, under the previous two papacies particularly, that they were treated like altar boys. The bishops went and they were told that they hadn't done this or they hadn't done that, or they were asked to make an account of themselves. And this bothered bishops. I've been reporting on Rome for many years, and you know, bishops coming out of meetings in the Vatican saying, yeah, they don't listen to us, you know, we're treated like altar boys. That has completely changed under Francis. They now go, and the heads of departments say to them, Pope Francis has asked us to listen to you. How can we help? They're bowled over by this. Then they go and see Francis, and instead of having this formal speech being read at them, he says, let's have a dialogue. And for 2 or 3 hours, they have these great exchanges. Francis is saying, what are the obstacles? How can we help? They look at pastoral challenges together. I've been following on Twitter some of the reactions of the US bishops who are now in Rome on their ad limina, and they are bowled over. They are really amazed. So I'm hoping that great things will come of this ad limina visit. Now, my friends, what I want to go now is I'm going to dig quite deep. I have to warn you, I'm going to go a little bit deep here, because I want to talk about Francis's, the real substance of his leadership as a discerning Jesuit. And it's to look back at a bit in his life. Those of you who read the biography will know that he was a very successful Jesuit provincial and rector of the Collegio Maximo, which was this huge body in Buenos Aires where the new Jesuits and many others were trained in theology. A dynamic provincial who filled the place with vocations to the point where in Rome they were scratching their heads asking, what are they doing in Argentina that we're not doing elsewhere? But then in the 1980s, some of you may know the story, he's then dislodged by the Jesuit authorities in Rome in collaboration with a group of Jesuits in Argentina who didn't like Bergoglio, who didn't like what he was doing, and they dislodged him and his followers. There was this kind of revolution within the province, and Bergoglio was after a few years, a very difficult few years, was subject to a kind of exile in a place called Córdoba in inland Argentina. Now, before then, as a Jesuit, which then led to, a period which is now very fruitful in his pontificate, this is what I want to explain to you. In that first phase, before we get to the exile, while he's a provincial and a rector, he writes some extraordinarily powerful writings on the nature of the Jesuit leader. So these are writings where he's applying the spiritual exercises and the constitutions of St. Ignatius to leadership. And he really was a captivating leader who really had a deep understanding as a Jesuit of how leadership is to be conducted. And I'm going to give you just 5 little examples of this wisdom. So first of all, he writes a lot about how the superior's task, the provincial's task, is to build belonging. The object of leadership of an apostolic body is at what's called a union of wills, to form people into a people, to form a body into a people, which means, of course, building love and trust within the body. And that as such, the leader here is the conductor of processes, as he calls it, and not the administrator of an order. So you're not merely administering as a leader, you're conducting a process, which is really about allowing the Holy Spirit in. He writes a lot about, secondly, the use of power. In one of his finest essays on leadership from 1981, he talks about the importance of discernment in enabling a leader to distinguish between what may appear small and insignificant, yet requires correcting now, and, for example, some big issue which can be left for a later time. It means not being deceived by what can appear to be weakness or strength. Now, this is a major failing of many of our political leaders, is that they hate to look weak and therefore often will make very bad decisions. He says, a leader requires, in St. Ignatius's words, fortaleza, which is strength, which should not be confused with fuerza, which is something like force or might. So real strength is often not force. Quote, a common deception is to be weak when one is strong, and vice versa, he writes, unquote. It's saying there is a good strength and a bad strength. In the service of God's kingdom, you need both courage and constancy. Courage to take up the cross, you know, sometimes leadership is extremely difficult, but constancy, sometimes you just have to stick it out. A third insight, that God's action, and remember we're talking here about a leadership which opens up a body to God's action. God's action always takes place in the here and the now. It's concrete and it's in the tiny details. Good leadership in a religious institution is about cooperating with that action and not blocking it. So a key principle is not to demand more or less than is necessary and to demand it in the moment that that demand can become grace. Yeah? And big plans often fail because they fail to take into account limitations. They reject. The problem with idealism is that it rejects the fragility of human beings. And he talks a lot about how the Lord's action is always taking place within human limits. Fourthly, bringing out the good in others and not looking to your own reputation. A good leader seeks to discover the good in people and help them to discover that goodness in themselves and how that goodness can benefit the whole institution. Never being ashamed of people, that it's not about gaining or controlling spaces, but knowing how to create this harmony. And finally, it's all about building the body, allowing the people themselves to become protagonists. He has a very interesting essay reflecting on why is it that Jesus in the gospel avoids the existing power groups in Israel. So you think about the Sadducees, we have the Pharisees, we have the Sanhedrin, the Zealots, and so on. Why is it that Jesus doesn't belong to them and instead goes straight to the people? And his answer is because all those groups were seeking to deny the people their own protagonism. They all wanted to arrogate that power, as it were, for themselves, and so became a blockage to God's action in the here and now. And above all, and this is a key thing for Bergoglio, avoiding ideology. Ideology is a kind of taking refuge from the here and now, from the reality. It's to retreat into the gnosis, into the idea, into abstraction, which ceases to become incarnate. This is a very, very strong idea of him. You're probably familiar with, in Evangelii Gaudium, the four principles that he talks about. Time is greater than space, unity prevails over conflict, realities are more important than ideas, the whole is greater than the part. There's a lot to be said about these, but fundamentally they are magis criteria. There are criteria for navigating tensions while keeping your eye on the big horizon, which is always unity, the whole, the building up of the whole. And then a very important point, that God enters history above all through the poor, as the Beatitudes teach. Not necessarily the materially poor, but those who yearn for what is right. Because the experience of injustice, whether you're a poor person who has experienced injustice, or you are somebody perhaps better off who feels that injustice very intensely if you work, you know, in these fields of, you know, migration or whatever, that what you're doing is you're opening up space for God to act precisely because your heart is open. That there is a patience in the poor. They don't try to conquer spaces, but rather trust in processes. They don't take refuge in abstractions, but are attentive to realities. And therefore, the church must always be embedded in, linked to, focused on, attentive to the people, the poor, the ordinary people. He has a very rich idea of the people, the church as the people of God. Now, I know we talk about the church as the people of God as a kind of theological idea. He really means it, that the action of God is taking place in the ordinary faithful people. And the church's problems begin when, as an institution, it abstracts itself in some way from the people of God, becomes detached from the people of God, and starts to lord it over them in an attitude of superiority. So clericalism for Bergoglio, for Francis, is what must be overcome in the church. The great sin of the church is clericalism. And clericalism isn't just a matter for clergy. Many lay people can be clericalist as well. It's all those authoritarian attitudes which detach the institution from the church. At the origin of the sex abuse crisis is clericalism, is the idea, is what has been created as a ministry of service to the people has been perverted to become a source of power over them and exploitation ultimately. I mean, there are many forms of abuse, not just sex abuse, but ultimately clericalism is reflects what he calls, is a great Bergoglio expression, the isolated conscience. That there are people whose conscience is isolated from the march of the people of God. They hang back, a kind of distrustful self-withholding, an attitude of superiority, of distrust, who are often, of course, obsessed with orthodoxy, obsessed with liturgy being done a particular way, because they're isolated from the reality of the people of God. So much of the opposition to this papacy, I think, comes from people with an isolated conscience. And he would talk also, and this is relevant to the criticism of the papacy, he talked a lot about the isolated conscience as a refusal to evangelize. And he talked about Jonah, you know, the story of the prophet Jonah, who's sent by God to evangelize the city of Nineveh, a great, big, sinful city. And God says, go and proclaim the good news to them. You know, preach forgiveness. And Jonah doesn't like this one bit. He's a good, uprighteous religious person who says, no, they're lost, they're condemned, they're not saved, you know, I'm not going there. So he tries to go back to Tarshish, and you know the story, the storm, he ends up in the whale, blah blah blah. But really, when Bergoglio has reflected on this, on the story of Jonah, he loves the story, he says really Jonah's refusal was the refusal of God's mercy. He hates the idea that God could be for others, not just for the righteous, and that's why he runs away. He says Jonah had become a prisoner of his own certainties. He had fenced in his soul with the barbed wire of those certainties that, instead of giving freedom to God and opening up horizons, end up deafening his heart. How the isolated conscience hardens the heart. And then he talks about the risk of the isolated conscience of those who, from the closed world of their Tarshishes, complain about everything, or, feeling their identity threatened, undertake battles to feel more busy and involved. So the isolated conscience as a source of opposition, as an excuse for not evangelizing, often characterizing those among us who are the very religious, the very righteous, the ones who accuse other people of being heretics and not being faithful Catholics, are often these ones who are in a kind of Tarshish, want to stay in their Tarshish and are refusing to evangelize. The second phase of Bergoglio's life that I just wanted to refer to was the period of what is sometimes called his exile. So, late 1980s, he's dislodged, he's displaced from his position of leadership. His followers are scattered to the four winds. And he ends up, and it's a long, complicated story, which you can read about again in this book, but in more detail in The Great Reformer. He ends up in Cordoba, which is a mountain city, lovely place, but he's given no role whatsoever. Very unusual for a Jesuit provincial, particularly he was the leading figure of his time in Argentina. So he took care of the elderly, he heard confessions, he meditated, he prayed, he read a lot, and he wrote some of his most searing and powerful meditations. And there was one particular book that made a big impact on him by a Jesuit called John G. Navone, a wonderful book called A Theology of Failure. That's what the book was called. And here, Navone offers an account of why God chooses to save through powerlessness. In other words, why the method chosen for salvation is the sink takabasis, the coming down to coming close, and the self-emptying, and ultimately the failure of God on earth, if you like, was God's way of saving. You know, the world judges Jesus a loser. He doesn't convert Israel. You know the story. He leaves intact the structures of the time. And his disciples, after the crucifixion, as we all know, are in a place of complete desolation. They don't understand what's happened. It all looks successful. Now suddenly it isn't. But in the resurrection, God overturns that judgment, transforms Jesus' followers' understanding of what God's reign really involves: freedom, non-violence, and what the world saw as weakness and failure. So the drama of the Christian proclamation springs, doesn't it, from that central paradox that the true power operating in history is not the one that we think of as power. So in reading Navone, Bergoglio, who'd already written about all this stuff, I think his own personal experience of desolation and powerlessness, he finally kind of came to understand that he had moved too far and too fast. He had been too much of a Tarzan leader, you know, too much of a kind of a Superman. That his incredible power as a leader to mobilize, to inspire, had brought with it a kind of temptation, as he put it, to bring forward the triumph without passing through the cross. That really he was learning much better the paciencia, the patience, and paciencia means suffering. That true change is brought about in a way through being willing to suffer for a future as yet unseen. Yeah? That ultimately that is faith, that we need to have faith in that power which is truly operating in history, which so often we can't see. And you all know what I'm talking about because you know it from your own lives. So what he came to understand, I want to suggest, at a very visceral level, was the wisdom of St. Ignatius's rules for how to act in desolation. But the brilliance of these writings is that he applied them to apostolic bodies. Apostolic body, you know, like the Society of Jesus or indeed the Church. And what he showed in these writings, and I've written about them at length elsewhere, is the temptation faced with tribulation. Tribulation at the moment would be the sex abuse crisis or secularization. You know, when the Church suddenly finds itself not respected in law and culture. That's all been a tribulation for the Church in our modern times. That what happens in tribulation is that there's a risk of taking our focus off Christ and rather looking at the waves, like Peter being invited out from the boat. And that in taking our eyes off Christ, we turn in on ourselves. We retreat into our institutions, into our comfort zones. But what he shows in these writings is that we tend to lose the capacity for discernment when we give in to that temptation. And we start to see everything in terms of goodies and baddies. We're the goodies, they're the baddies, like Jonah, right? And that we stop offering Christ and instead we reduce faith to a kind of an ideology, a set of principles or ideas. Now, Francis keeps repeating in his pontificate what Benedict said at the beginning of his first great document, Deus Caritas Est. Right there in paragraph one, Christianity doesn't begin with an idea or an ethical proposition, but the encounter with a person, Jesus Christ, who changes your horizon. That conversion happens by the encounter with a person. It's not an idea. Christianity isn't an idea. It's a person. And that then changes your horizon, and of course that leads then to new ideas. But if you lose Christ at the center of it, if you lose the encounter, then what you end up with is a set of precepts or ideas which are cold. So you've reduced faith to ideology. Now this is at the heart of the discernment that he and the Latin American Church made in 2007 when they gathered for the first continent-wide meeting of bishops in Latin America for 25 years. It took place at the Shrine of Aparecida in Brazil in May 2007. And the principal author of the document that resulted from that was none other than Cardinal Bergoglio. And it was really his discernment that lies at the heart of the Aparecida document. Aparecida specifically deplores attitudes in the Church that saw only confusion, danger, and threats in the world outside, or which sought to respond to change with worn-out ideologies or irresponsible aggressions. Now, immediately you can recognize, can't you, in that, the stance of many of our churchmen in our time, in America, in Europe. You know, that angry, condemnatory stance, where you're blaming the Church for the Church's failure to evangelize. Oh, if only the culture supported Christianity, if only we could go back to the good old days of the 1950s, right? It's a very, very interesting, it's a very accurate discernment. The great achievement of Aparecida was to reject that and to recognize that that was a temptation and instead to respond to the tribulation of change with the discernment question, which is, what is the Holy Spirit now asking of us? How do we need to change in order to evangelize the contemporary era? Now, I've talked about this in the book, as rejecting the temptation of lamenting and condemning and instead embracing the path of discerning and reforming. Not lamenting and condemning, but discerning and reforming. This was the key shift in Aparecida, and I continue to insist, and I'm sure I'm right about this, that Aparecida produced in that document the profoundest signs of the times, discernment of modernity of the church anywhere in the world. There is nothing like it in America, in Europe, in Asia, or in Africa. It really is a very profound discernment. They look at the world, a world of liquidity increasingly, a world increasingly dominated by globalized technocracy, the breakup of institutions, the expulsion of Christianity from law and culture. They see that the faith transmission belts are breaking or fraying. In other words, the traditional means of communicating and transmitting the faith through the generations, through institutions, family, parish, school, they're all breaking down under globalization. And that in this context, the church has to refuse the temptation to retreat behind its walls and has to go out to the peripheries, to the people who do not know Christ, to the poor, to the suffering, and to offer not an idea, but the encounter with the person of Christ. And what they call the encuentro fundante, the founding encounter, is what? It's an experience of mercy, because God is mercy. Therefore, to encounter God is to encounter mercy. And what is mercy? Again, the thinking in the document is very clear, and you can see it in the Francis Pontificate. Mercy involves three basic steps. The first step is the Samaritan step, coming close, coming alongside, not responding with an abstraction, but coming close to the reality. Because suffering and poverty is always hidden, it needs to be discovered. So the first step is to come close, to welcome. Secondly, there's a process of accompaniment or discernment where we work out what is a person's needs, where is their longing, how is God working in their lives. And then this third stage of integration and salvation, yeah, where change happens. To the extent that we know Christ, that we have had an encounter with Christ, we have experienced that, haven't we? That is actually how God saves the world. That's how God saves humanity. To the extent, therefore, that we offer God to the world, we must offer the mercy of God. Firstly, that's the first proclamation, is mercy. And then the transformation happens. It flows from that. But the church has too often forgotten that, lost that primary encounter, and instead has offered Christian truth as if it were an idea. Cardinal Bergoglio once said that truth is like a precious stone. When you offer it in your hand, it's compelling, it's captivating, people want it. But if you throw it at somebody, it bruises them and they bleed. It's the same stone in both cases. Truth is still the truth. But in the second case, you're offering truth without the experience of mercy. Without mercy. You're offering it without the person of Christ. So the truth becomes detached from mercy, and that's when it becomes not only not capable of evangelizing, but in many ways can do a lot of harm. Is that not why we here today, we Catholics, we know the church, I hope you'll agree, as a place of love, as a place of mercy. Many of us have found a belonging here in this parish, in this church. We owe the church, you know, our lives, and we want other people to know that too. And yet the perception of the world outside is of a moralistic, haughty, defensive, self-protecting institution that puts its own interests above those of humanity. And that perception, I want to suggest to you, is because the church has lost that capacity to proclaim the mercy of Christ. That is why at the heart of the Francis Pontificate is mercy. Is closeness. I have a whole chapter called Close and Concrete. He wants the church to emulate the sink takabasis of God. God saves by coming close in concretely through mercy. He talked at Aparecida and would talk again in 2013 of a journey of reorientation to free the church from being a self-referential church, looking at itself, but rather to experience the joy of evangelizing, to go out to the periphery, to offer Christ, and therefore the consolation, the joy of that. The church changes when it evangelizes. It becomes joyful. It communicates what it is that it's offering. Now, when Bergoglio gave that homily in Aparecida, and when he repeated it more or less again in his speech to the cardinals in March 2013, the cardinals who were there were captivated. And they said, that's it. He's nailed it. You know, there is something there. They felt the Holy Spirit. Those who were at Aparecida describe it as a Pentecost event. The bishops arrived very much in a state of fear and desolation about all the problems facing the church. But they left 2 weeks later with this parousia, with this boldness, with this zeal. And that's exactly what happened to the cardinals who then decided to elect Jorge Mario Bergoglio in 2013. I want to just end with an example of the application of this same discernment in the sex abuse crisis. in January 2018, Francis went to Chile, and there there was a huge controversy over his defense of a bishop whom he had named 3 years earlier, called Juan Barros, who was accused of covering up for a notorious priest abuser called Fernando Caradima. I tell the story extensively with a lot of background stuff in the book. But basically, there's a shift in Francis. He starts off his pontificate on this topic, believing that sex abuse can be dealt with as a series of priorities, of policies, if you like, which he's trying to hold in balance. And they're good policies. They're policies developed under Benedict. Yeah? But then when Chile happens, he comes back to Rome, he realizes he's got it wrong. He sends his chief prosecutor to Chile to find out, to get testimony, to investigate. And Archbishop Scicluna comes back with this report this big. People were queuing around the block to tell their stories. And what he comes back with in this report is an unmistakable picture of corruption, an institution which is deeply corrupt. The legislation to prevent abuse is all there, but they're not following it. They're covering up for each other. Now, for Bergoglio, sin and corruption are two different things. If you're a sinner, there's a part of you that wants to change. There's a little part of you that says, I wish I weren't sinning, right? So when the church comes and offers mercy, you respond. The church says, hey, what? We'll wipe the slate clean. All you have to do is change. That doesn't work with corruption because corrupt people deny that they are sinful, right? And it's even worse in the church and in other institutions which consider themselves good, who idolize themselves. Corruptio optima pessima est. The corruption of the best is the worst kind of corruption. Because when you believe yourself good, then you resist the idea, you can't accept the idea that you could be sinful. So at the heart of what was going on in Chile, he recognized this corruption. Corruption can only be dealt with, first of all, by truth. So you have to face the truth of who you are. Again, it's the spiritual exercises, week one. First of all, we face the sinfulness of who we are. And we have to experience the shame of that before we are willing to change. So what happens in 2018 is that he calls the Chilean bishops to Rome. He hands them a 10-page letter, which documents in excruciating detail the corruption in the church. And he says, go off and study that and come back and pray about it. And by the end of the week, the entire Chilean bishops' conference had offered their resignations. And here in America, we had the explosion of the Pennsylvania report, we had McCarrick and so on. And Francis saw this as the spirits moving, that the revelation of the past, this was the truth that we had to face. What is the truth that we had to face? That in many ways the church had become clerical, clericalist. It had had a perversion of the idea of ministry. Ministry had become a source of power, and that power had led to corruption. So he starts to talk about sex abuse, not just about sex, but abuse of power and conscience and sex. Anyway, what I document in the book is how he's leading the church throughout 2018 on a kind of retreat, inviting all of us, the whole body of the church, to be converted, to be purified, because, and he sees it exactly the same way as the spiritual exercises set out. Truth, shame, opening ourselves then to the mercy of God, allowing ourselves to be transformed, and transformed, we then go out on mission. That's the dynamic that he's presenting and inviting us to follow. Now, you know that it has been very difficult in the United States. A lot of people read his letter to the people of God and said, you know, why should I, you know, pray and fast for these corrupt bishops and corrupt priests? But there's a much deeper understanding of what needs to change. It can't just be a matter of law, and it can't just be a matter of morality. So what I show in the chapter is that he's inviting the church on a retreat, on a place of conversion, and he's asking us to see that there are ways of evading that conversion, temptations, which are being fought. And I'm going to give you the three major temptations that I think were apparent then, and I'm sure you'll recognize them because you've lived through this. The first temptation was what I've called the Veganista temptation, naming after Archbishop Vigano. Now, you remember Vigano calls on the Pope to resign. And he lists, basically for Vigano, it's homosexuality. So he says, we've got to purge the church of the gays. Get the gays out. Oh, and the liberals, you know, purge the church. Moral rearmament, moral purification. Yeah. Well, the problem with that is it's superficial because... First of all, the people that abused were often very moral, were very orthodox Catholics who believed in sexual morality and certainly wouldn't have considered themselves gay. So we have a superficial response, which makes people feel good, but really isn't a real response. We also have the response of the victims' abuse groups, many of them, which are calling for a kind of juridical zero-tolerance approach, where we treat the institution of the church like the mafia. We call in the FBI, we sack the leadership, you know, we find out who's guilty, we punish and so on. Again, does that work? Well, in Chile, they had zero-tolerance measures and they were ignored. A purely juridical approach won't solve the deeper problem. Then we also have measures which are designed to appease public opinion, and I document one that the USCCB followed in November 2018, and I put it there in detail, and I'm very confident of the truth of the account. Some of you may have heard that the USCCB don't like my account. We can deal with that in the Q&A. But nonetheless, that was another temptation, you know, to appease public opinion. But actually, they did something which wasn't good law, and it wasn't reconcilable with universal church law. So what was Francis looking for in it all? He was looking for a radical purification. He was looking for a conversion. And that's why he called the bishops' conferences of the world together in February of this year, and he made them listen to abuse victims' testimonies, searing testimonies. And by the end of it, even those who were convinced that it wasn't their problem, Africans and Asians, came away saying, we've got to root this out. And then Francis produces law to enable that. Do you see the point? So first of all, the conversion of hearts. Then we have good law to support that change and the necessary structures. So these are, I think, basically the application of the spiritual exercises to the leadership of the church. I just want to end with one other aspect, of course, of Francis, which makes him very much a Jesuit. You know about desolation and consolation. Consolation is always marked, isn't it, by a kind of a joy. Even if we're in situations which are sad, there's an underlying peace, there's an underlying joy there. In many ways, week three of the exercises, when we gaze upon Christ on the cross, is the most difficult part of a retreat. But the most challenging part of those four weeks of the spiritual exercises is in many ways week four, when St. Ignatius asks us to rejoice in the giftedness of the whole of the world and the whole of creation. You know, he has this meditation, contemplation on attaining divine love. An Argentine Jesuit who's very close to Francis put this to me. He said, the real challenge is, can we not just feel compassion for those who are suffering, but can we rejoice with those who are joyful? I want to end with this idea. The heart of the people of God ecclesiology of Pope Francis, the way he understands that God is present in and building up his people, God's holy faithful people, is marked by joy. You know, the ordinary people is a place of joy. I was watching in the Newman canonization, which I was there for, I watched because I had a wonderful seat by the altar. Anyway, at the end of Mass, Francis goes down. I'd never seen this before from this vantage point. He goes down from the basilica steps. He goes down the steps into the square. The Pope Mobile is waiting for him. And he gets on, and I was very struck by this. He gets on with this incredible kind of energy. And he goes into the crowd, and the whole crowd erupts with joy. And Francis is just beaming. And I suddenly realized that what this Jesuit had said to me was true. The people of God are flocking to him, and he is experiencing their joy. And is that not why joy so marked this pontificate? All his documents have the word joy in them. It's the joy of God, it's the joy of consolation, the joy of evangelizing, the joy of the people of God. Thank you very much. I might have gone on a little bit longer than I was supposed to. I apologize. What would you like to do? Would you want to do a Q&A now? Shall I pass the microphone around? Have we got another microphone or just the one? Okay, well, no worries. Here is the microphone. Welcome to have it. Who would like it? As long as you give it back to me for when I answer. Who would like the microphone?
Thank you so much. Thank you for being here. You referenced at the beginning about the filter of our media, and I'd appreciate your just commenting a little more on least historic, I'll say, kind of opaqueness of what happens. I mean, unless somebody does a book and tells us a lot about this, it seems very this intentionally. I'm sure some of it's just due to my own personal ignorance. Some of it's due to the media, but I can't blame anybody. It feels like it was been deliberate. And I'd also like you to comment on with this, our current Pope, how he may be making it a little more transparent.
Just ask the last question again, sorry. Just the last bit.
Also, how our current Pope may be making this a little more transparent.
Making what, sorry?
Making the visibility of what goes on and why these things go on within our church. We're among the faithful, and yet it still seems very opaque, and again, discounting my own ignorance on that.
I mean, this is really a question about how the Vatican communicates. It's okay, I've got it. Sorry. I'll have to hold it. It's a big topic. We have, for the first time, a Pope who stands up at the end of every trip, however tired he is, and I've been there on papal trips, he comes out to the journalists, and he stands there for us. And the first time he did it was the flight back from Brazil. For a whole hour, he stood there, and he said, ask me anything you like, and gave these extraordinary answers. And that's carried on. So this tradition of the spontaneous papal conference, I think, has opened up a whole method of communication, which is very, very important. But there's no question that institutionally, there are huge obstacles to us understanding what's going on in Rome. Because we have a Catholic media, sadly, especially in this country, which is deeply ideological, which looks at everything through a filter. And we have the crazy end of it in LifeSite News and Church Militant, but we have the main Catholic organization here, EWTN, which sadly has programs which are dedicated to the proposition that the Pope is a heretic. They try and not say it quite so directly, but that is the implication. They're obsessed with the idea that the church is surrendering to modernity, and that filters everything they see. One little anecdote from the Synod. I've just been in the Amazonia Synod. You know, you probably heard about the so-called Pachamama statues affair. I can tell you where that originated. I was walking down the Borgo Pio, and an EWTN journalist showed me a picture of one of these wooden figurines and says, what the heck's that? And I said, well, it looks like a rather charming statue or carving from the Amazon. And he said, but they're worshipping it up at the Vatican Gardens with the Pope. I said, you can be fairly sure that if they're in the Vatican Gardens with the Pope, they are not worshipping it. They are putting it there along with the canoe and other symbols of their culture because they wish to honor God in creation and through all created things. But I said, anyway, Alan, I better not give you his name, but anyway, I said, surely you'll go and ask somebody. Don't ask me. Go and ask one of the indigenous people, ask one of their pastors, ask the synod organizers. The next day, a story appears without a single person being asked about it, and it was written up as worship of pagan idols in the Vatican Gardens. Now, that story then got modified and corrected, but by then the narrative was set, social media was on fire, and then we had this obsession. And the Vatican was just astonished, you know, the Vatican, because, I mean, in the press conferences every day, we have, well, will the Vatican clarify, are these pagan idols or not? And you see the Vatican gave, they're wooden figurines. I mean, one of them actually did refer to her as Our Lady of the Amazon. Well, but she wasn't. She was a pregnant woman, bare-breasted, as Amazonian women are. Beautiful image of life, of creativity. I mean, you walk into my house, and half of the images of my house are not images of the Virgin Mary. That doesn't make them pagan idols. But anyway, so I'm as you can see, I'm upset about this. But the point is, I didn't think the Vatican was actually very effective in providing a narrative for this sector of the church here, which is obsessed with this kind of thing. You know, because they just didn't understand how. You know, so I think there is a major gap. I think there's a problem partly in the Vatican. I think it's mainly a problem of reception here through these ideological filters. And I'm not sure how to resolve it, but I appreciate that it is a problem, and I appreciate how hard it is for the ordinary faithful people to get accurate, proper information about the Pope. So I hope I'm doing my bit, and I know there are other people who are. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Lisa Ammon. Thank you so much for being here. I'm so excited about this Pope's leadership. One, and your talk, too, particularly about mercy and encounter or, you know, coming close, as you talk about. And one thing I wonder about is how many women the Pope comes close to on a regular basis and how many women who are, you know, either women who are women who are experiencing the church and their leadership in the church, because it seems to me that bishops are supposed to be the shepherd of the flock for priests and deacons, who are all men, and then the cardinals, and then so forth, and then there's so many men, it seems that even if everyone is in the good spirit and in the good process, there's like so many layers of not encountering women. And then the experience of that is, as a Catholic, is, you know, this is the church that introduces me to Christ, as you say. And yet, as I get older and older, the experience of it is not only clericalism. The clericalism doesn't surprise me, because I've been dealing with sexism and sort of this superiority of maleness for such a long time that it's very hard to figure out how to... It's a balance trying to figure out how to raise daughters in this church. They're here. They're both here right now, actually.
Hello, daughters. Hello, yeah, daughters. Well done for being here.
Yeah, 7 and 10. So how is the Pope's leadership relevant, and what can we do? Is there a crack? What can we do right now? We have a synod here in this bishop. What can we do right now? Our bishop is going to his ad limina 6 or 7 years on January 13th. Please instruct us. Tell us what he's doing and instruct us, please.
Sure. Well, on the topic of women, first of all, I have some pages in the book on this. It's not an easy topic to respond to, because the Pope's own response to this is continually to say that the church has to find a way of integrating the presence and voice of women into its thinking, into its structures, into its way of being, in such a way that doesn't also clericalize and functionalize women. He's convinced that to see this as a purely functional or organizational problem is to miss out, if you like, on the prophetic power that women have. So he's very convinced that women have a distinctive voice that the church needs to better integrate. Nobody's entirely sure what he means by that, and I suspect it's more of an intuition on his part. That doesn't mean to say that he isn't integrating at a very practical level in the Vatican women, and there are now 6 women, and I document in the book, who occupy major executive positions in the Vatican, that meaning either prefect, secretary, or subsecretary. And that's historic. I mean, now you might say, well, that's not very many, but actually, it's significant progress. The International Theological Commission now has a number of women. Again, for the first time, he's appointed women to the Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith as consultants. Now, these may not look like major steps, but they are significant within that world. And the women I interviewed for the book who work in the Vatican say that there is now a conversation about women that was not taking place before. The UISG, the Union of Superiors General, which represent the religious of the world, the women leaders there, have a rather remarkable relationship with Francis. I mean, they really do have a great relationship with him. And, of course, in response to them, he appointed the Commission for Deacons, which he's now going to reopen. So these are all steps. These are all steps. They may not look like very much, but I think they're substantial. And he's opening up a process, I think, which will lead. Now, where will it lead? Interestingly, in the Synod on the Amazon just now, we had a lot of really amazing women come and talk to us in the press office, give testimony each day. Women religious, indigenous leaders, as well as lay women, who occupy very significant roles in the Amazonian church. Here's a statistic: of all the Catholic communities in the Amazon, almost all of which do not have a resident priest, 60% of them are run by women. Okay, so women have a key role. Now, in the Amazonia document, it says that the presidency of these communities should be recognized formally by the church, and they even say by a bishop laying on his hands. Now, this is really significant. I think, actually, this is more significant than the female diaconate. And women, various women said to me, who I interviewed, you know what, we don't want to be clergy. We want to be leaders and have our leadership recognized. So I think in this realm of ministeriality, as they call it in Spanish, ministerialidad, I think we're seeing some significant openings which Francis can now take up in his response to the Synod document, which could well lead to changes. Yeah. Just the last thing I'll just say, because you started off asking about his own contact with women. I do know one woman in particular who's extremely close to him, who he phones every week and whose advice he incredibly respects. And I know there are other women in his life, if I can put it that way. There are many women in his life who he really does look to for counsel and advice. So there really is nothing about him that resists in any way the advice of women. I think he's extremely open to it. Thank you. Where's the microphone? It's coming.
Thank you. This is a wonderful talk. I work with women and men. I am a cradle Catholic. I've got 1 foot deeply in this church. I can't extract it, even though sometimes I would really choose to do that. But I do minister to a lot of women who say, I can't be a part of this church anymore. It is not my truth. What is there in here for me? I can go to the ocean and find God. I can read music and find, or listen to music and find beauty. I can read books and find truth. This is enough. The church is full of all of this corruption and disloyalty and confusion and sin. So I'm asking you what you think Pope Francis would say I should say to people.
And I'm going to ask you what you say to them when they say that to you.
I say, I understand. I feel your pain. I am also torn, and I live in this tension. And then if they are open to any more conversation, I say, I drink from the sacramental grace in the church, and this is what I need to survive. But I also totally understand their need for truth and beauty and goodness as it comes purely out of the font of nature and other people. And they go to other churches.
Well, thank you for your testimony, because I think you've responded beautifully, much better than I can, really. I would just say this, really, that I often find behind this question or behind this objection is a presupposition that the church should be a good institution. I don't think the church has ever been a good institution. It's always been a place of spiritual combat. You know, what is of God is attacked, is tempted. Therefore, I mean, some of the perversion and the corruption we've been talking about with the sex abuse crisis, there's something very profoundly good there, ministeriality, service, which has been perverted diabolically. But it's only been capable of being perverted because it starts off as good, because it's of God. What is of God will always be prone to corruption. So therefore, the church is a place of spiritual combat. That's how I answer. And I say, we need you inside, please, to help with that spiritual combat. Those people who drink from the wells of nature, well, you know, I'm the same. And the great thing is that Laudato Si is a major breakthrough in Catholic social understanding and thinking, because the giftedness of God we now recognize in creation. And just literally yesterday, I think it was, Francis announced that he would be including ecological sins now in the catechism. There is no reason why we should not be confessing, you know, deliberately using a paper cup when we could have used a styrofoam cup when we could have been using a carbon one. These are major developments. I mean, you know, so I would say to your friend, you care about nature, you care about ecology. The Catholic Church is now the leading in the world agent of campaigning on behalf, particularly of poor countries, on the issue of climate change. I tell the story in the book of the effect that Laudato Si had on the Paris Climate Agreement at the end of 2015. Francis remains a major figure. Jeffrey Sachs the other week was telling me, you know, without Francis, we wouldn't be where we were, right? Look at the Amazon. What other organization in the world could bring together the indigenous leaders of the Amazon, put a spotlight on the Amazon for the whole world and say, we have to save these people and their environment if we're to save the world? There's nobody else doing this. So I would say to her, we need you because of what you believe. Thank you. Where's the mic? I'll come to the peripheries.
Just a quick papal story and a question. In 2006, I happened to be in Buenos Aires, and I went out to a casino gambling. And being a good Minnesota Catholic, I felt guilty about winning around 1,000 Argentinian pesos. So the next day I went to the Metropolitan Cathedral right off the Casa Rosada. And when I went in there, I was very shocked because there were hundreds of people because it was 1 year from the anniversary of this fire, which killed, I think it was 200 or 300 people. And I was standing in the back, and in comes the cardinal, and here I am, a Minnesota tourist who's feeling guilty about being out to 4 a.m. gambling, and he looks at me and he smiles, and he just had this unbelievable presence of being a shepherd. And I think you have that in your, a lot of that in your book. So it was kind of amazing to read a book and be there as very much a sinner and just to see how he related to people. But my question for you is somewhat ideological, especially here in the Twin Cities. I live in the east side of Minneapolis, and there's tons of Catholic churches. And over the years, I've gone to a lot of them, and I find very much two different Catholic churches. There's kind of a social justice, I would say more liberal church, a place like St. Joan of Arc, and then there's a more right-wing Catholic, Latin Mass people. And when I go there, I find two completely different experiences and two completely different groups of people. And a couple years ago, I just happened to look in the parking lot, and at the more liberal Catholic church, I didn't see any Trump stickers, and at the more conservative one, I didn't see any Hillary Clinton stickers. So I guess my question to you is it really one Catholic church, or what's kind of the future of that situation?
Yeah, thank you. It's a beautiful question. It's a question about polarization, which is now affecting not just the church, but of course wider society. I come from a country which, as you may have heard, is at the moment polarized and paralyzed. We've all divided into two tribes of leavers and remainers. And I'm sad to say also our church is becoming increasingly polarized, partly under the influence of the US church, which has been deeply split for many years. Sadly, the USCCB last week again just showed how completely divided it is. And the Pope has said to the US bishops, you know, you will never be taken seriously, you will never be credible until people see you together. That's why he invited them to go on that retreat at the end of, the beginning of 2019 at Mundelein Seminary. He sent all the US bishops on a retreat together. It was an amazing experience for them. I think they had never done that, spent a week in silence and meditation together. So you're highlighting, in a way, the very issue which I was talking about in my talk, that the purpose of spiritual leadership is to form us into a body. We're deeply split. We reflect the cultural split of our society, our tribal split, and to that extent we are incapable as a church of evangelizing until we show that we are what in Latin is called a coincidentia oppositorum, a mechanism for integrating difference. Then we will never be capable of offering the person of Jesus Christ. So the question is how we overcome those splits. And I think the answer is being offered right now by Francis in the synods, in synodality. Bishop McElroy, if you haven't seen it, has written a superb lecture, which is the best thing I've read on the American church, which is up at the National Catholic Reporter. Really worth reading. He was at the Amazonia Synod, bowled over by it, comes back and says, this is what we need in the American church. And I'm delighted that you're holding one here in your diocese, and I'm really interested to hear about that. And how, I don't know if anybody wants to tell me about it afterwards or now, I'd be very interested. Because it's only by listening, only by, we have to learn to be a church where disagreement is fine and difference is fine, but we need to be a reconciled diversity. We're polarized not because we disagree, but because we have failed to be fraternal. We have to learn fraternity before we can learn how to disagree properly with each other. And there's a lot in Bergoglio's thinking about a reconciled diversity that I think would be incredibly wise and fruitful. And I hope in the next book, by the way, to deal with some of this, because I think our time badly cries out for it. But thank you. Thank you for the question. Thank you for your lovely testimony about Cardinal Bergoglio in Buenos Aires.
Thank you for being here today. We're honored by your presence. I couldn't wait for your book to come out, so I got it online. And I read your chapter on ecology and conversion and Laudato Si. It's wonderful. I encourage everyone to read your book and that chapter. My question is related to the conversion. When you were talking to Pope Francis, Did he give you any indication that we're moving fast enough as a culture in relation to our conversion? And did he have any suggestions for how Laudato Si can be embraced by the Catholic community and the entire community, really? Other religions are excited about Laudato Si as well. But anyway, thank you for chapter. It's wonderful.
Thank you. Because I'm pleased with that chapter, because I think what it shows is that Laudato Si is much more than an encyclical about ecology. It's actually about how we it's an ethical reformulation. That the church's ethical offer in the modern world should be one where of an ethic of life. If you care about the unborn child in the womb, you have to care about the rainforest. It's the same ethic, which, by the way, Benedict, I think, spotted very well. But as for the implementation of Laudato Si, no, I didn't talk about it with him. I did talk about Guardini and the end of the modern world and Guardini's vision of the future, but that's okay, I'll leave that for now. But it's clear from what he said that he's impatient. He's sad that Laudato Si has not yet been embraced, especially by, it has to be said, the world's biggest polluter, right? The real issue is here in the United States. It's US and China are the two big countries where the conversion needs to take place dramatically and radically if we are to avert the disaster which is coming. And of course, the church here, there's been some signs, and I acknowledge them in the chapter, solar panels on diocesan chantry roofs. I mean, there's progress, but nothing like what there needs to be, and that's sad. And there's an issue there about the reception of the Francis Magisterium here in the United States, which was highlighted by the nuncio, the apostolic nuncio to the U.S., Christophe Pierre, wonderful man, at the beginning of the Baltimore conference just now. He gave them a speech, please look it up, pretty strong stuff, saying you need to implement the teaching of this pontificate. Hey, it used to be the case that faithful Catholics were loyal to the Magisterium of Rome. He didn't say that. I'm adding that. But that's a big issue. Yeah, we have to. I mean, ecological conversion, which is a change in our mindset, which is what he himself underwent, as a result of his contact with some big issues, and I document them in the chapter. And particularly Aparecida again. Aparecida, all the bishops came with stories of environmental destruction, which were also stories of the plight of the poor. And that's when he started to see that the cry of the earth and the cry of the poor are essentially the same cry. That's where God is speaking right now to our world. And we have to listen to it and be converted or perish. Thank you.
Austin, thanks so much for joining us. My name's Julie Craven. And I noticed you will be in Georgetown on Wednesday. You are putting some miles on these days, aren't you? We follow you on Twitter, so we
Very
know what
good.
You're up to.
Thank you.
The title of your talk, the Salt and Light series, is going to be about nationalism and Pope Francis. Is that going to be a similar conversation, do you think, to the gentleman's question in the back? Or do you see that conversation going in a different direction?
Yeah. Well, I'm part of a panel, so it's not my talk. I've been invited onto a panel to discuss the theme of Pope Francis, nationalism, and something like that. I haven't looked yet. but it's with Ross Douthat of the New York Times. It's with Matt Sittman of Commonweal and Leah Libresco. And I look forward to that. I'm also giving a talk the night before in Holy Trinity Parish. Nationalism is a big... The rise of populist nationalism is a big theme at the moment in the world, which deeply concerns Francis. And I was speaking about this yesterday in Notre Dame about the Abu Dhabi document. Has anybody heard of the Abu Dhabi document? You see the media here. I think it's one of the most important developments in the church the last few years. In February, Francis goes to the United Arab Emirates and celebrates, by the way, the first ever public Catholic Mass on Arabian soil, which the media all did report. But then he signed with his friend Al-Tayeb, who's the Grand Imam of Cairo, this remarkable document on human fraternity, which commits Muslims and Christians to work together to build a different future, a new future, where God is sovereign, but it's not the national populist shtick. And so what he's trying to do there is break the stranglehold which he perceives of, on the one hand, fundamentalist religion, which then produces a reaction in national populism, which that offers to protect Judeo-Christian civilization against the enemy and the foreigner. So you can see how these two feed off each other. You know, Al-Qaeda commits an atrocity. The national populace says, we've got to keep these immigrants out, you know, build a wall, Trump's language. So he sees this dynamic that has to be broken, and it can only be broken by religious leaders stepping forward and saying, this is what religion really stands for, and it's fraternity. And he says there, beautiful phrase, that religious diversity is willed by God. It caused a lot of controversy among certain sectors. But we can only have fraternity because we are different. We need the freedom to become one, to learn how to be brothers and sisters in, you know, under the same God. And I think it's a profound document. It's a charter for all religious people and people of goodwill for how to build a future from the ground up, rather than allowing the agenda to be taken over by national populism, which is a huge threat right now. We're going back to, this is how fascism was born. This is what fascism looked like before it became fascism. It started with this rhetoric. Demonization of the foreigner, the idea of Judeo-Christian civilization, build a fortress. And then we end up with trade war. We start with trade wars. The barriers go up. Pretty soon we're back in a war. So I think he sees this as a major world emergency, and he's working actively to counter that. Please look it up. Abu Dhabi, or the document on human fraternity, it's also known as, February of this year. Beautiful document. It's not too long. Really worth reading. He described it in Morocco as a big dream he had with a friend.
One of the things that really stuck out from the very beginning of your talk and the different phases of Pope Francis's, when he was in Argentina, the two things that really stood out was the idea of the kenosis and God coming, revealing himself to us through the poor and the oppressed. And then the other one was this phrase, the protagonism of the people. And what strikes me is so much about that is the Brazilian influences of like Paulo Freire and the pedagogy of the oppressed, and then liberation theology, although he's not a liberation theology. Could you talk a little bit about those influences on Pope Francis? Were they influences, or are they just, this is where the gospel leads if you follow it?
Yeah. I'll try not to give a whole lecture on this because it's a big topic. In The Great Reformer, my first book, I talk about it in some detail. That when we say, is Francis liberation theologian or not? Well, first of all, he's not a theologian. But is he a follower of liberation theology? Well, yes and no. It depends what we mean by liberation theology. If we mean Latin American theology post-1968, post-Medellin, then certainly deeply influenced by Latin American theology. There were some strains of that Latin American theology, which became known as liberation theology, which adopted a Marxist hermeneutic, a sociological way of looking at the world in terms of power relationships and so on, which for the Argentine theologians, who became known as the theologians of the people, was unacceptable. There was a split in the early 70s between a kind of Marxist version. I'm not talking about liberation theology as wanting a Marxist government, but I'm saying that the methodology was Marxist. And this other group, which the Pope was very much identified with, which was all about understanding the culture and faith and the history and the tradition of a people. Now, the thing that distinguished the two groups was popular religiosity. For the Argentine groups, they saw in the traditions of popular devotions and popular religiosity, they saw, you know, the presence of the relationship with Christ, which had grown up over time of a people, and that had to be, it was that had to be preserved, acknowledged, and so on, and built on. Now, a quick history of this. I mean, basically, as you know, the Vatican condemned that one branch of liberation theology, never condemned liberation theology as a whole, in fact praised it. It was Cardinal Ratzinger who praised liberation theology in his second document. But anyway, long story short, collapse of the Berlin Wall, the Marxist element has died out. And in a Aparecida, you see the triumph, in a way, of that people version of liberation theology, which is associated with the Argentines. So yes and no is the answer. Thanks.
Thank you again. Some questions about women and the church.
Oh, boy.
I wonder, when I think about the church, and the church is speaking to women sometimes, and what are the changes that need to occur so the church can then speak for women? We hear now about there's a possibility that we might have some women in administrative positions. But if our concept of the divine is both male and female, and I'm talking to you as a cradle Catholic, as someone mentioned earlier, how do you see and where do you see the road, if you will, the path for women moving into ministerial positions? When do you see, and will it ever occur, that we change some of our pronouns for the divine? If God is both male and female, the God I know in the Catholic Church is only addressed primarily as a male. So again, we look at the responses to the question this lady posed earlier, how do we respond to women? I'm staying because I think this is still my church, but because I care about my church, I think my church has to look at probably 55% of its population who are church members.
Yeah, I don't really want to say much more because I gave quite a long answer before, and I don't want to go back over that. You know, in other words, I think there are new paths being opened up in this pontificate. I'm not sure where they're going to lead, but I think it's in the realm of ministry and the recognition of the authority of women's ministry as a distinct non-clerical ministry that I see the opening. But it's also possible that now that he's reopening the commission on the female diaconate, we may get women deacons in the future. Personally, I'm a bit concerned that we don't go the role of the Anglican Church. It's called the Anglican Church here, it's called the Episcopal Church, which has become very clerical. You know, it's full of women clergy, but I'm not sure about the lay people, you know. So I think it's a complex question, and I think new paths are being opened up. The Pope wants those new paths opened up, but I'm not entirely sure where they will lead. And as far as my own role, I try and be a little bit careful in, you know, I'm not a theologian, I'm not an expert on any of these questions. My role is to, you know, communicate and put a narrative on what I think the Pope thinks and what he's doing. And that takes me a little bit outside my area. And I'm very aware, I don't want to start pontificating on the Pope's, but to put words in his mouth that I think would be inappropriate. So I'm going to dodge the question, if that's all right.
Thanks. I was listening to that part where you were saying that there's an anti-clerical movement from Pope Francis.
Anti-clericalist.
So really what he's asking people to do is go down to the people and ask them what they say. But that's the definition of populism, really. So I don't know how you define populism, but I mean, it's just as popular in the Arab world too to go down to those people and ask them about what their tradition is. I don't know if you know about Wittgenstein, but he says that everybody's got their own tradition in their own language. So the Catholic Church has their own language, and that language is the words of Scripture, which were interpreted by the magisterium. So wouldn't that be the opposite of the anti-clerical movement? And the priest should be clerical to tell the people, this is the tradition, this is the truth, this is what was written in Scripture.
Yeah. So, sorry, just to be clear, when I say that Francis has kind of declared war on clericalism, I don't mean to say that he's anti-clerical, which is the word traditionally associated with anti-Catholic or anti-church movements. Okay, he deeply values the priesthood. He deeply values the celibacy of the priesthood. And there's absolutely no diminution of the role of the priest in his own thinking and teaching. And if you want an example of how he's reforming the priesthood, read the Ratio Studorum, which is beginning to be implemented here, which is this whole new vision for the training of priests, where he has this very, very beautiful view of the priest and the priesthood. So the priesthood is you know, the pastorality of the priest, the idea of the priest as being the good shepherd, representing the heart of Christ and expending himself for the sake of humanity and the poor. All that is absolutely a key part of his thinking. Some of his most beautiful addresses are directed, you know, to priests. So I don't see any shirking of the role of the priesthood. What he's against is the corruption of the priesthood as a mechanism of power over rather than power for. So it's authority, but not dominion, not domination. Does that make sense?
Katerina speaking. Thank you so much. You mentioned throughout your talk that wonderful notion of conversion, which I think is what it's really all about for everyone. I've been at the St. Paul Seminary for 28 years, and people here know a lot about some of these things. But my question is, the Pope has spoken occasionally to groups of seminarians, and he's been pretty clear about the type of people he would like to be priests. But the Ratio Fundamentalis, which is that document you may be referring to, is pretty soft in a way. It certainly says some wonderful things about what should be, but the way it is interpreted, and it's from 2016, yeah, is not very strongly right by seminaries. And it's very difficult because most seminarians come from parishes and from families that are very traditional, and they don't, that's not broken in most of the seminaries. It's really hard to think about how the church is going to change until that younger generation of priests is different. Has he said much more? Do you address seminaries in your book is kind of the question.
Thank you, Sister Pat. We were together recently in a Cambridge conference. I do address the issue. I talk about, the Ratio Fundamentalis, as I should have called it. I do talk about it a little bit. But I certainly talk about him addressing the question of rigidity in the book, which is a big theme for Francis. You know, because it's quite good to just think about this for a moment. What is rigidity in young people particularly? It is an understandable desire to take refuge from a world of instability and uncertainty and relativism. The problem is that you then project onto the church an idea of the church which really doesn't exist, an idea of something outside time, something, you know, so objective that it fails to touch actually human realities. It's an idealized abstraction of a church. And that's what produces rigidity in young people, as you, I'm sure, know very well. I'm interested in your critique of the Ratio. I talked to Archbishop Patron Wong recently in Rome, who's responsible, and we had quite a long chat about it. He said it's designed to be implemented by each country gradually in a different way. So much, in other words, is going to depend on the implementation of it. It certainly is not going to produce dramatic results in the short term. We probably have to undergo a generation. So maybe this is the moment, if we're coming to the end, where I just go back to what I said in the talk. Real change, real conversion, takes place over time. It's organic. It's often invisible. The real revolution of the gospel, in a way, happens through patience. And maybe many of us here tonight who are impatient to see change, maybe that's the invitation to us to learn, a bit like Navone says, to suffer in patience with the Pope in seeking to bring about these changes. But if I could just end by saying, I really hope, thank you for letting me be with you today. It's been a real privilege, a real honor. And I know that the Pope, I don't speak on his behalf, but I know he always asks people to pray for him, and I know that you will want to pray for him every day, as I know I do, in his mission. And I know that that's very important for him, particularly now in the United States, to know that there are good, faithful people in a parish like this with the Pope and praying for him. Thank you very much indeed. Thank you.